Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Johnson, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals, or welcome to wherever you are today. We're hosting the oral argument by Zoom, interactive video. And what that means, a couple of things. One, apparently Zoom has been a bit glitchy in the last few days. So if it turns out we have any technical issues on any basis, if you have a hard time seeing or hearing anyone of the panel members or your opposing counsel, please somehow signal us and we'll pause the proceedings until we can get things squared away. Even though we can see each other and we can see each other's names, are because we're only providing making an oral recording, not a video recording, you'll need to state your name as you commence each leg of your argument as you proceed through the proceeding today. So the case on for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus Hagar. 15 minutes for appellant's counsel and 15 for respondent, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant for rebuttal. Appellant's counsel, whenever you're ready to proceed, you certainly may.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Andrea Bartz. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Sean Hagar. Your honors, the issue in this case is whether the district court committed reversible error when it allowed the state to present relationship evidence that Hagar searched for and watched pornography, showed pornography to the alleged victims and his son, and asked KH to sexually touch AA. Evidence was not admissible as relationship evidence under Minnesota Statute Section 634.20 for two reasons. First, the evidence was not domestic conduct under that statute. And second, even if it was domestic conduct, it should not have been admitted because its probative value was substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice.
And you agree that we're only dealing with a plain error review?
Yes. Looking at the statute would be de novo and then plain error. That's correct.
I'll just tell you where my biggest concern is with the prejudice prong in your argument. Given your client's admissions to police and the other significant evidence, can you address how this allegedly improper evidence is prejudicial, substantially affected his rights?
Yes, Your Honor. It did affect the outcome of the verdicts. There were three separate victims here, three separate sentences consecutively ordered for 144 months each. I guess in response to the state's argument about the confession, that only related to AA, this evidence was definitely prejudicial as far as all the verdicts, I'd argue, but definitely with regard to count one and three for GA and KH. It was admitted through a very persuasive way. Every victim testified about it. The social worker King testified about it. Detective Pulin testified about it. In addition, Exhibit 2 was admitted and sent into the deliberation room with the jury, which was that long list in my addendum of very graphic titles about the searches and videos watched. The state used this evidence in its opening and closing, read six of the graphic pornography titles from Pulin's testimony and Exhibit 2. In closing, you can see that on page 381. One of the titles was Father Rapes Little Girl. So these were extremely inflammatory titles that surely distracted the jury from legitimately deciding Hagar's guilt.
But counsel, given the context of this case, searches for videos involving fathers and daughters and things like that seems to have tremendous relevance. And I don't know how the probative value of that evidence could be outweighed by its prejudice.
Well, I think we have to back up just a little bit and look at, before we even get to the prong about prejudice, we have to decide whether it's evidence of domestic conduct. So,
well, that's a very broad category. It's not limited to what's in the statute. It says it includes these things, but is not limited to. And this certainly seems to be domestic conduct. It relates to a familial relationship and the context of that and the searches. Beyond that, I'm kind of troubled and I look at, I think it's the Muriel case or whatever, where our court has said that this kind of grooming evidence of videotapes and the like is part and parcel of the crime. So it's almost just a relevancy argument at that point, not a domestic or a 404B argument. You understand what I'm saying?
Sure. If we go to the probative value, these were not needed to prove any elements of the offenses, and it wasn't established that Hager showed the alleged pornography to the victims during those offenses. And Hager's son being shown pornography.
But counsel, just if I'm going to rob a bank and 2 weeks earlier I buy a ski mask, that may not have happened at the time I robbed the bank, but part and parcel of robbing the bank was getting the ski mask. And that's certainly relevant that I went to Walmart and bought a ski mask 2 weeks before the bank robbery. How is cultivating and grooming these children not connected and relevant to what happens later?
Well, it wasn't established that this long list of 30 some searches and titles that he showed all of that to the alleged victims or his son. So Mr. Hager searching for or watching pornography alone is not domestic conduct under the statute. If we go back to the reading of 634.20, you can see the phrase domestic conduct or term is used multiple times. In the first sentence, it says evidence of domestic conduct by the accused against the victim of domestic conduct. So if we use what we know from McCurry and Barnes-Slater and the statute, we know that the term victim of domestic conduct means that it's the victim of the current charge. So we know that in order for the statute to be utilized, a defendant must be charged with conduct that amounts to domestic conduct. So it can't just be anything. In order for the statute to apply, the defendant's underlying conduct for the charge has to amount to domestic conduct. And domestic conduct's repeatedly used throughout the statute. So when we look at the first phrase in the statute, it says evidence of domestic conduct by the accused. Evidence of domestic conduct refers to the relationship evidence. So again, domestic conduct is used twice in that first sentence and again later in the statute, but it has to mean the same thing each time. So when we incorporate the definition of domestic conduct from the second sentence of the statute, we can conclude that evidence of domestic conduct must mean other conduct that amounts to a violation of one of the statutes listed in 634.20 or evidence of domestic abuse as defined in 518B.01.
Counsel, how do we get around the Ramey case, which indicates that where the defendant uses that evidence, he really waives any claim that it was admitted improvidently?
It was a pretrial motion in limine granted by the court pretrial. Mr. Hager was pro se, and it was used in opening statement by the state, and then the three victims testified before he made or asked the question to the son's mother about if anything had been inappropriate, and she said he had watched pornography with the infant son. So he's entitled to a defense. He's entitled to defend himself. And that was a pretrial ruling. So I don't think that impacts the court's analysis. The court should start with the statute itself, what we know from McCurry and Barnes-Slater. This isn't domestic conduct because none of these crimes or none of these bad acts amount to a violation of any of the crimes listed in 634.20. It wasn't a order for protection violation, Danko violation, harassment, restraining violation, stalking violation, and it wasn't domestic abuse as defined in that statute. None of this conduct amounts to physical harm, bodily injury or assault, infliction or fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury or assault, terroristic threats, CSC, interference with an emergency 911 call. Given the fact that the relationship evidence statute can only be used if the defendant is charged with domestic conduct and that the term domestic conduct must mean the same thing throughout the statute, we know that evidence of domestic conduct must mean other conduct amounting to a violation of one of those enumerated statutes in 634.20 or conduct that amounts to domestic abuse. The state argues that the phrase but not limited to makes it so that domestic conduct means more than domestic abuse or a violation of the enumerated statutes in 634.20, but that can't be true because we have separate rules of evidence that exist for the introduction of other bad acts. And but is not limited to, and the definition of domestic conduct can't mean that it includes any other bad act evidence. Because again, we know the offense charge must involve domestic conduct in order for the statute to be utilized. And the phrase domestic conduct has to mean the same thing throughout the statute. So the phrase, but it's not limited to, still requires domestic conduct to be conduct that constitutes domestic abuse or violates one of those enumerated statutes listed in 634.20. In the very least, the evidence of domestic conduct admitted must be similar evidence to domestic abuse or the violations enumerated in 634.20.
Ms. Bartz, would you agree that we would not reach your 404B argument if we rejected your relationships evidence argument?
I'm arguing under the harder standard that the probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, and it's should it be excluded for that reason.
Well, you're arguing, I think, that the 634.20 does not apply.
Oh, and no, I'm saying that it can be utilized in our case because in our case, there is a victim of domestic abuse because Mr. Hager is charged with CSCs. But then you have to look at the first term in the statute, which says evidence of domestic conduct. That's the relationship evidence. None of the stuff that was admitted amounts to domestic conduct. Searching for and watching pornography, showing the victims and his son this alleged pornography, asking KH to sexually touch AA aren't violations of any of those enumerated statutes in 634.20. And they don't amount to domestic abuse as defined by 518B.01.
And therefore, I think you're arguing that section 634.20 does not apply to this case, does not apply to the evidence. Is that right?
It can't be admitted because it doesn't meet the definition of domestic conduct under that statute.
Right. And so then, I mean, let's say if you were successful in persuading us of that, then I think your 404B argument would become relevant. But if we were to conclude that 634.20 does apply and does call for the admission of the evidence, then it seems to me there's no need to analyze the 404B argument. Agree?
Yes.
Okay. So you made, switching, new question now, you made an argument earlier that his watching porn alone does not is not part of domestic conduct. But I assume you're basing that argument on his own testimony. But I mean, how do we parse out? I mean, let's assume for the moment that his watching porn, he watched it sometimes alone, but also sometimes with children present. If there's some conduct, domestic conduct involving porn, then isn't that enough to implicate the statute?
Well, we have to look at what the district court did, and the district court just let everything in as domestic conduct under 634.20. It all came in, and then that exhibit too went back into deliberations with the jury, and I think it was all too much. It's too prejudicial. There was no need for it, no real probative value. It wasn't related to the offenses. It just allowed the jury to infer that he had searched for porn, watched it with children.
Let me press again on your argument as to prejudice. I mean, each of the children testified to sexual conduct that it's obviously objectively much more inflammatory, concerning than merely watching pornography. So in light of the evidence of your client's actual conduct, I'm at a loss for how the additional evidence of viewing pornography would add substantially to the gravity of the jury's concerns about your client in relationship to children and sexual conduct.
Well, I think it came down to the victim's testimony versus Hager's testimony, and this testimony about all his other bad acts. It was
right, but when you say victim's testimony in this case, it's plural. It's multiple victims testifying to similar conduct.
Yes. But again, AA had disclosed once before and not been believed. KH waited years to disclose. And GA said penetration occurred on direct and then said the opposite on cross. So this evidence did unfairly sway the jury. It swayed them by illegitimate means to find Hager guilty. So in conclusion, we would ask the court to grant him a new trial because this erroneously admitted evidence was prejudicial and affected the verdicts.
And just to be clear, you're not challenging all of the pornography testimony, only some of it.
I'm challenging all of it. It was all admitted and it had low probative value. It only acted to show that my client was a bad man capable of abusing these girls. And it persuaded the jury and distracted them from actually weighing the evidence.
As to Judge Kirk's original inquiry, though, about grooming, since there was some testimony that your client showed the videos to children, some of the pornography to children, assuming that's so and that it's grooming, do you acknowledge that at least some of the testimony about pornography is admissible under that theory?
I believe GA disclosed that she was shown a pornography or video, but it wasn't at the same time as the date of the offense.
Right. But I mean, if Judge Kirk is correct that grooming evidence is going to be admissible, irrespective of the familial relationship and the evidentiary rule allowing for evidence of the relationship. Well, first, let me just ask you: do you concede that some of this evidence is admissible on other grounds?
Well, Your Honor, it was only admitted under the relationship evidence statute 6334.20. So, under the statute, it clearly doesn't meet the definition of domestic conduct. And even if it could be admitted under some other ground, it was still too prejudicial to do so.
All right. Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal if the other panel members don't have any other questions. Oh, Judge Kirk, yes.
Can I follow up just a bit? I think what undermines your argument somewhat, counsel, is that the appellant himself admitted to the police that he was using these videos and specifically referenced daddy-daughter videos to try to desensitize his children to what was going to occur. It just seems like, given that and the other things, it's very hard to see a situation where this would constitute plain error, where the judge should jump in and object, so to speak, when they're really... was no objection by the appellant at trial to the admission of this.
Well, again, he was pro se, and there was no evidence that Hager showed all the videos to the alleged victims or his son. That was a very long list. I hope you look at it. It's in an addendum of my brief. And it was plain error because the evidence, it was just substantially prejudicial.
But counsel, he was pro se, but he had burned through several public defenders, apparently, in a system I don't understand, but and then had advisory counsel throughout the trial. So, you know, he chose to go forward on his own, and the court provided him with counsel to answer any questions you have.
Sure, but the court still committed reversible error because it was required to look at the statute. And in order to admit the relationship evidence, it has to be domestic conduct. It has to meet the definition in the statute. And then it has to have probative value that's not substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And we have McCurry, Barnes-Slatter, 634.20 to prove it's not domestic conduct, and that was plain error. And then we have Stroman to show that this evidence was so prejudicial it should have been kept out. In addition, Rule 403 has the same test as the statute 634.20. The evidence is excluded if its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, and that's what happened here. The evidence shouldn't have come in. Even if it does come in, it was just so prejudicial that he should be granted a new trial. Thank you.
Just so we're clear, you're not actually arguing that there's a different rule that applies or a different standard that applies when a defendant is unrepresented?
No, Your Honor.
All right. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal, and we'll turn to the state. Respondent?
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovich. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney. I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. The respondent is asking the court to affirm appellant's convictions for criminal sexual conduct and to remand to allow the district court to modify the appellant's conditional release term on count three, as we conceded that issue in our brief. There's a few things I'd like to touch on based on the appellant's argument and the questions that the court had for counsel today. The first is the prejudice prong, the third prong of the plain error analysis, because obviously if the court finds no plain error, the court doesn't even have to engage with the statutory interpretation question posed by the appellant. And there's a couple of things I would like to emphasize with regard to the prejudice issue. First of all, as the court indicated, the defendant did confess really not once but twice to sexual abuse of one of the three victims, AA. And one of them, he claimed in his testimony, was essentially coerced, the statement to law enforcement. But first of all, you know, obviously that would not be taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the state. But even putting that issue aside, he confessed in a situation where there was no claim of any sort of coercion to a person he was speaking to via jail call as well. Now, counsel indicated that that's only as to one of the three victims. That's true, but I think that frankly, once you get a confession to one of three victims in a situation like this, that tends to corroborate the testimony of all three victims. He admits to doing the things that one of the victims said he did, and I think that makes it very, very easy for a jury to believe that he did the things that the other two victims said he did as well. And the only other thing I wanted to emphasize on that prong is that in her closing argument, the prosecutor did obviously discuss that evidence, but also provided what I think was a pretty clear and accurate statement of what the evidence was used for, is kind of reiterating the limiting instruction and saying he's not charged with possessing pornography or showing pornography to children or anything like that. It's only there essentially to help you evaluate whether he committed the criminal sexual conduct crimes he's charged with. And so she also emphasized that in her closing argument. So I just wanted to point that out. The second, moving to the second issue I wanted to address, and that was the question that was posed near the end of counsel's argument about whether any error was plain. And that's another way, again, the court can find that even if there were error, it wasn't plain, and also not have to deal with the statutory interpretation question that is posed here. And the counsel points to the Barnes-Slatter and McCurry cases, and I think those, she also pointed to those in her reply brief, and I think those deserve a little bit more elaboration, because neither of them really supports counsel's position here. And in the McCurry case, I think it's actually, the McCurry case actually, I think, strongly supports the state's position here. The main issue in McCurry was just whether for the relationship evidence to statute to be applicable at all, the defendant has to be charged with a crime that's a form of domestic abuse. And so obviously that's not the question that's posed here. But there's some language in that case that's really helpful here, where they discuss a little bit the language in the statute defining domestic conduct, talking about the not limited to language, that domestic conduct includes but is not limited to the following. And what the court said in McCurry was that not limited to language is more likely meant to encompass general testimony about the relationship including conduct that does not rise to the level of the crimes listed in the definition of similar conduct. At the time, it was similar conduct rather than domestic conduct because the statute was amended after that. But I think that that reasoning still holds today, even with the amendment to the statute, that by the very terms of the statute, it can't be just limited to those specific acts and crimes enumerated, because this text of the statute unambiguously says it's not limited to those things. So this, I think McCurry really supports the state's position rather than the appellant's. And the Barnes-Slater case, the question or the issue there was that this court held that the charged crime itself doesn't have to be a crime of domestic abuse or domestic conduct, but the question is really whether the conduct alleged met the definition of domestic abuse or domestic conduct, or in that case, I guess it was domestic abuse, I think. But really nothing to do, again, with the issue in this case. It was just defining sort of the threshold for what types of crimes, charged crimes, would this statute apply to. Really nothing to do with the issue here. So I think that even if there was error, what I'm getting at is it wasn't plain, because there is certainly no authority that it makes it clear and obvious, which I think is the language in the cases for when an error is plain, that this type of conduct isn't domestic conduct under the statute.
It seems to me, Mr. Hadukovich, would you agree? It seems to me that there's not a lot of case law about the statute after the amendment, and perhaps we don't have case law that fully explores the outer limits of the scope of the phrase domestic conduct. Is that a fair statement?
I would absolutely agree with that, Your Honor. And I think that supports the state's position here, that even if there were error, just assuming for the sake of argument, that it wasn't plain error, because simply put, there's nothing in the statute itself that makes it obvious that this conduct isn't included. The other thing I wanted to note with regard to counsel's argument is that counsel argues that the term domestic conduct must mean the same thing both times it's used in the statute. And I think that's probably right based on general principles. But the flaw there is that in order for a defendant to be charged with some type of domestic conduct, there has to be a crime there. I mean, obviously, you can't charge somebody with something that's not a crime. So in order to get in the door to a criminal prosecution, you need a crime. But that doesn't mean domestic conduct is limited to crimes. You're only going to ever get to the statute if you have a crime, first of all, and second, that is a type of domestic conduct. But obviously, when we have a crime, it's going to be a violation of some criminal statute. So the sort of the subset of situations where the statute is going to be even applicable is people who are charged with crimes that are a type of domestic conduct. But that doesn't mean that domestic conduct can't be broader than that. It just means that you can't be charged with a crime that doesn't violate a criminal statute. So then you get to, you know, what does domestic conduct mean more broadly? Well, I think the McCurry case gives us that, you know, a pretty decent answer on that, which is the not limited to language should probably encompass general testimony about a relationship and including conduct that doesn't rise to the level of a crime necessarily. And because otherwise, what would the purpose of that not limited to language be? I think it's the only way that it makes any sense. And it's the only way that we can give effect to that language. And here we have obviously conduct, as the court explored with counsel during her argument, that is really directly related to the crime. It's the grooming process, as Your Honor's described and as I argued in my brief. And so it's what gives rise to the crime. It's what normalizes to the victims this type of behavior by an adult towards them.
But it's only grooming to the extent that any of the victims were observing the videos.
I would agree with that, yes.
Mr. Hadukovich, when the state brought its pretrial motion on this issue, did it include or specifically reference Exhibit 2, the document? Quite often, it seems like relationship evidence in our experience usually is oral testimony. But mm-hmm. In this case, it could include that exhibit. I'm wondering if at the time of the motion that was included in the motion. Also wondering whether now you would agree that when analyzing this on appeal, when analyzing appellant's arguments, that we should, our 634.20 analysis should encompass Exhibit 2.
Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at the notice right now, the written notice that was filed, and the what it essentially talks about in the notice is that the introduction of evidence that the defendant exposed all three victims to pornography videos. And it says the evidence will be introduced by way of testimony and evidence that was discovered as a result of a search of defendant's iPhone 6. And so I think that it gives reference to the exhibit essentially. And I do think that, an exhibit, I agree that relationship evidence most often comes in the form of testimony, but sometimes it could be a conviction, which could be proven certainly by a certified copy. And there's nothing in the statute that would limit it to testimony, since the term is evidence and not testimony in the statute. So I think that the notice doesn't specifically say an exhibit, but it does reference the information in the exhibit. And the other thing is, of course, that the state is not required to give notice of relationship evidence, although we generally try to as a best practice, especially so that we can obtain a pretrial ruling on its admissibility, because the last thing we want to do is introduce evidence that the judge says should never have come in the first place. We want that pretrial ruling allowing it. And so we provide that notice, although it's not, I don't believe, required by the rules, unlike Spriegel evidence.
So I think you would agree then that if we were to ask the question that's in the third requirement of the plain error test, whether the plainly erroneous admission of evidence affected his substantial rights, we would have to consider whether that exhibit affected his substantial rights.
Yes, I would agree with that. And if the court found that there was plain error that in that exhibit being admitted in the first instance, correct. Because I do think, and I should note, by the way, just to make clear the state's position on that evidence, because counsel brought that up in her reply brief, that the state, I guess I may not have addressed that evidence directly in my brief in this case, the evidence, specifically that exhibit. But the state's position on that is the same as it is with the evidence that the victims were actually exposed to the pornography. It's all part and parcel of the same thing. And certainly if the exhibit can't be brought in, if the evidence of what the defendant is looking for on his iPhone and has on his phone can't be brought in, it becomes much easier for the defense to attack the victims and say, essentially, they're making up what they're saying about me showing them pornography. I never did that. The fact that he has not only pornography, but the same type of pornography that the victims described being shown to them on his phone, I think is really important in terms of corroborating their testimony. And it's really just part and parcel of the relationship evidence that he has this pornography and he shows it to them. It's really part and parcel. So that I just wanted to make my position clear on that issue.
When the child or children testified about being shown pornography, did they refer to a particular device such as his cell phone versus an iPad or the TV?
I think that there might have actually been multiple devices referenced, if my memory is serving correctly, because I believe some of it might have been on TV and some of it may have been on various devices. There were iPads referenced. But I don't think that ultimately matters here, because ultimately what the evidence on the phone demonstrates is just that he did indeed have that type of pornography, which I think makes it very unlikely that all three of these girls essentially made up what they were saying about what he was showing them. And the other thing I did just want to note too, and I noted it in my brief with regard to this issue, is that the appellant himself elicited some evidence, not that he showed the victim's pornography, but that he showed his son pornography as well. When he asked one of the state's witnesses about it, just essentially she was being very responsive to the question when he asked her if you ever saw me doing anything appropriate with my son, and she said yes. And when he asked what it was, that's what she said, showing him pornography. So some of this was actually elicited by the defense as well, which I think goes to the prejudice, as well as whether there was any plain error. But
I have another question. If I believe in your responsive brief, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe that you responded to the pro se supplemental brief that was filed by Mr. Hager. And my question for you is, I guess, and perhaps it could be a question for appellant's counsel as well, is whether all of the facts asserted in the pro se supplemental brief are in evidence, or whether the pro se supplemental brief goes beyond the evidentiary record. I mean, I understand he did testify, but I'm wondering if his testimony was as extensive as his pro se supplemental brief, and therefore, you know, how we treat the arguments and assertions made there.
Right. I didn't directly respond to it. You're correct, Your Honor. And maybe I should have been a little more clear about that in my brief. I didn't really read the pro se supplemental brief as frankly raising any legal issues, which is why I didn't respond to it. And I do think that the facts probably went beyond what was in the trial court record. And especially given the fact that the jury obviously discounted the appellant's testimony, even if the facts that are contained in his testimony are asserted as the truth in his brief, essentially, that they should be discounted for that reason, because the jury obviously found those facts not to be true. So you're correct, Your Honor. I should have responded to it more directly, but I don't think it really raises any legal issues that I noticed. It's almost, as I read it, almost more of a closing argument at trial than any sort of appellate issues that were raised. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to respond to that. I see that I'm out of time. Unless the court has any further questions, I would just ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. It does not appear that any of the other panel members have any questions for you.
Back up to the first sentence of the statute. It says, evidence of domestic conduct by the accused against the victim of domestic conduct. So it says domestic conduct twice, right? And we know from McCurry, Barnes-Slater, and the statute that the phrase victim of domestic conduct has to mean the current charge. So that in order for the statute to apply, the defendant has to be charged with conduct that constitutes domestic conduct. Then you look at the phrase evidence of domestic conduct. That's the relationship evidence that's coming in. It has to mean the same thing. We look at the second sentence, and we can conclude that evidence of domestic conduct must mean other conduct that amounts to a violation of one of those enumerated statutes in 634.20 or domestic abuse as defined by 518.01 subdivision 2. All this evidence about the pornography and whatnot, that doesn't meet the definition of evidence of domestic conduct under that statute based on McCurry, Barnes-Slater, and the plain language of the statute. It just doesn't. We don't get there. It's not even similar. So I think the court can find plain error there. Even if the court doesn't find plain error, it should still find plain error on the second part, because evidence should have been excluded because its probative value was substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice.
Ms. Bartz, there are a number of cases. I mean, I say a number. There's a mountain of cases where, on other issues, our court or the Supreme Court has said, well, you know, any harm by the improperly admitted evidence is mitigated almost entirely by a limiting instruction. And in this case, we do have limiting instructions. So can you address the issue of prejudice in light of the district court's express restraint on the jury and how it considered the evidence that you object to now?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. The jury instructions here did not lessen the prejudicial effect of the evidence. A cautionary instruction was only given before AA, GA, and KH's testimony, but it didn't tell the jury what the relationship evidence even was. And no cautionary instruction was given before the social worker King's testimony or Detective Pulin's testimony, which was extremely damaging and included Exhibit 2. The instruction at the end of the trial only told the jury that the evidence, the relationship evidence, was between the defendant, AA, GA, and KH. Again, it didn't make any mention to Pulin or Exhibit 2 or King, or mention the testimony about Hager showing his son pornography. So the instruction at the end didn't tell the jury what the relationship evidence was either. Usually it says you're going to hear evidence that on whatever date the defendant, none of that was in any of the instructions.
Now, Mr. Hager did argue, correct me if I'm wrong, he tried to make the case that the children were sexualized for reasons outside of himself, and that the children were in fact looking up pornography on the computer. Am I correct about that? And if so, wasn't he relying upon the evidence, at least to some extent, that you're now challenging for the sake of his own defense?
Well, again, there wasn't established that the big long list of searches and pornography titles in Exhibit 2 was shown to the victims. It was dates from like 2016 to 2018. And this was, again, a pretrial ruling by the court. It already let the evidence in. The state used it in its opening. The victims had already testified about the pornography before my client started asking these types of questions. So he is entitled to present a defense and try to mitigate the evidence that was already coming in, Your Honor. So in conclusion, this court has two grounds upon which to find plain error and find that these errors affected the verdicts in this case. And so we would ask that the court order a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your written submissions and for